Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. This is the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. That's why I named it the Scott Horton Show. Yeah. Anyway, hey, thanks for tuning in. It should be a good show today. I got Marcy Wheel. Oh, man. Why do I always got to start out the show biting my tongue? Literally, not figuratively. I got Marcy Wheeler coming up. That time I said it very carefully and I didn't injure myself. Just trying to talk. Marcy Wheeler, EmptyWheel.net is her website. Empty Wheels, who her persona is on the internet. And we're going to talk about the new NSA stuff. Oh, we got some new NSA stuff. In fact, I want to talk about the new stuff and the stuff before last, too. New and that last one. That last one. All right. Yeah. So, unfortunately, we're still waiting on the big scoop, which Greenwald said was coming out last week. And then he said, oh, great. Now the U.S. government has called us. And he later elaborated, they've said he's got something factually wrong. And he has to go back and triple check it before he can proceed to publish. He says it's not something that they said, oh, this is secret and you're going to get somebody hurt. He said he already dismissed all of those concerns of theirs long ago. This was, according to them, a factual error that he's got to nail down before he publishes. All right. I'm waiting. That's coming up. But this recent Barton Gellman story, what, it broke Saturday night, I think? Is that right? Sunday's paper? Anyway, latest Barton Gellman on the NSA. Groundbreaking stuff. Marcy Wheeler's going to be here to break down the groundbreaking thing. Also, Mitchell Prothero will be here. He will be on the line from, I think he is still in Erbil, Iraq. Whoa. Up in Kurdistan. I want to go back and listen to that and see if you can hear it. How well. 943. Could you hear my stomach growling, chat room guys? By the way, there's a chat room. If you want to hang out in the chat room while I'm talking with Marcy or Mitchell Prothero. Got something to say or, you know, just want to talk about El Caminos with the boys or whatever. Join up. It's scotthorton.org/chat. scotthorton.org/chat. Mitchell Prothero, he's been reporting for McClatchy newspapers from Iraq for the past few weeks, Syria before that. And now he's in Erbil, which is up in Kurdistan, just on the Kurdish side of the line. Smart move on his part. Anyway, he's got some heavy-duty reporting to do here. Apparently, last Friday... this story didn't really come out until Saturday. But apparently, according to multiple sources and video and etc., Omar Baghdadi, whose real name here is Ibrahim Awad al-Badri, supposedly, who is now calling himself Caliph Ibrahim, the leader of the Islamic State, in the nations formerly known as Syria and Iraq. He led the Friday prayers in Mosul in a really old and important mosque, and it was a really big deal. Talked about a little bit with Patrick Coburn on Saturday. He was in Jordan. That was for the Sunday show on KPFK, Anti-War Radio. Airs every Sunday morning on 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. So I recorded, well, only half an hour of it played on KPFK, but the whole interview is 45 minutes. You can find it there at scotthorton.org/interviews, my very latest one with Patrick Coburn, and covered a lot of ground in there, too. It's a really good one. But the story was just breaking then, and, you know, the only dispute that I saw about it was the Iraqi government said, that's not him, this is a farce. But come on, farce? Like, the more you protest, the more seriously I'll take you. Make an argument. You have his picture and you've compared it and you are certain, or you know this guy, or what is your point? And it just seemed to me, and they could be right, I'm not saying I know for a fact, but it sounded ridiculous, actually. It sounded like, you know, desperation on the part of the Iraqi government. I mean, what was even their point? That he's got, that he's already dead? Or that he's too afraid to come out and give the sermon himself, so he sent his cousin? Or what are they even claiming? They're not even claiming anything. So, apparently that's him. And Prothero points out, I don't want to give away the whole interview here, but Prothero points out that, oh, they filmed it in high definition. And, you know, obviously, you know, they understand that that means all the facial recognition, this and that, will be applied. The Americans presumably have his mugshot from when he was being held in American custody in prison there. So they'll be able to verify, and they're not saying it's not him. And it's been since Friday, so apparently it is. The worst propaganda against him, I don't know if it was the CIA or if it was the, you know, just local media or what, you know, who picked it up, who really made a big deal about this, but apparently he has a fancy watch. And they're saying, ooh, nice fancy watch, Mr. Caliph, who shouldn't have fancy watches. So, okay, sounds like, you know, it's not really in dispute whether it's him or not. And then, I don't want to give too much of away. I'll let Prothero talk about his journalism on the show later to tell us what all was said, what it all means. I don't know. I'll tell you what it means. I'll tell you what I think it means. I think it means that, yeah, the Islamic State really is a state now. The Iraqi army can't do anything about it. With full-scale American support, they can do something about it, maybe, but I don't know how full-scale that support is ever going to get. They haven't started bombing yet, the Americans. Or if they have, they've maybe done some strikes in secret or something, but there's certainly been no official start to the new campaign. I mean, it seems like the Obama administration really is taking the Israeli view that they rather let Al-Qaeda get away with it if it weakens Iran. Even though Iran is not America's enemy, and Al-Qaeda is. But Israel hates Iran more. So, geez, if it comes to really fighting a war side by side, basically, or at least providing air support for the Iranians against ISIS, maybe the Mujahideen aren't that bad. Ronald Reagan liked them, right? That's the equivalent of Lincoln did it. Hey, Ronald Reagan liked them. George Bush never stopped the Saudis from financing them the whole time the Americans were at war with them in Iraq. Obama's been at least de facto backing them this whole time in Syria by continuing to undermine the Assad regime instead of backing the Assad regime, or at least letting it alone to fight ISIS and destroy it. So, ISIS has, they dropped the IS, because now it's just IS. The Islamic State in the land formerly known as Eastern Syria and Western Iraq. Northwestern, you know, this and that. And anyway, I don't know who's going to take it from. The Turks, this whole time, they've been friends with Nusra, at least, and helping the jihadis all, you know, get to Iraq, get to Syria, and now to Iraq. I guess the assumption is that if they really take on Jordan, that the Jordanian army would need help, and that America and or Israel would absolutely have to jump in there to protect Jordan, to protect Israel. And I don't know. I'll go ahead and spoil the Coburn interview for you. It's a great interview all the way through. But at the end, we kind of agreed that they pretty much are at stalemate in Iraq right now, and yet they're still going to fight it out anyway. Neither side's going to let it. No side is going to let it alone. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, all Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the Liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, y'all. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Like I say, Marcy Wheeler's coming up on the show. And so is Mitchell Prothero. Tomorrow, Deborah Sweet will be on from World Can't Wait. I'm going to ask her, like I asked the Code Pink ladies, what are we doing about this new Iraq war? Kind of picking up the same vibe for me that Obama and or maybe the Pentagon are kind of reluctant to do this? I don't know. I mean, obviously, there ain't no such thing as the Pentagon. Each and every one of them generals is an individual with his own selfish interests. Of course. But, I don't know. Seems like there's a bit of a reluctance. If there is, then of course that just means that the only opposition to the government's, the administration's position is the war hawks, criticizing them for not doing enough. So, the less we want done, the louder we better be about how against we are, against the any new war in Iraq we are. And they've already sent the drones and the helicopters. It's a matter of minutes before they start firing. Making this war our war. I mean, not that it isn't the U.S. government's fault, but that doesn't mean we have to just keep killing people over there forever and ever. At some point, you have to knock it off. How much worse can you make it? And I like Deborah Sweet, and I like World Can't Wait. They seem to have their priorities straight when it comes to stuff like this. And I'll admit to you that I was pleasantly surprised to hear what Jody from Code Pink. She was just on the show last week. I can't remember her last name. But anyway, she was great. And she said, hey, man, good news. MoveOn.org and all the Democrat, you know, quote-unquote grassroots groups, they're good on this, and they mean it. And they're working on Congress, and, you know, we don't have masses of people, you know, throngs and giant crowds of people surrounding the White House and the Capitol, screaming and chanting and demanding no war. And we need that. We need as much public protest as possible about Iraq right now. And things could get much, much worse. I mean, man, what are we talking about? We're talking about war in Iraq again. And this thing could escalate and escalate. They've already gone from 300 advisors to now 1,000 troops, helicopters, and armed drones. And they haven't even gotten started yet. They're only just beginning to get in position. And see, here's what I think is going on here. I think that, yeah, maybe there's, you know, part of the Pentagon agrees with Obama about getting out of Iraq and always wanted to just go ahead and go. But then on the other hand, there were some of them that wanted to stay forever. And in fact, I just posted a clip on my Twitter page the other day of Jim Mikleshevsky from NBC News saying the Pentagon wants to stay for 20 years. I actually have it, but what's the point of playing the clip? And this was right when Obama was saying, nope, we're sticking by the deal that Bush made and we're getting out by the end of 2011. And yes, he was wishy-washy on what's a combat force and what's not. But he clearly wanted to at least mostly get out. And Jim Mikleshevsky's like, well, psh, Over here at the Pentagon, the attitude is, I don't know who this president thinks he's kidding, but we're not leaving. Iraq is ours. We, killed and stole it fair and square, and now it belongs to us. Pretty sure that's the exact quote. No, I made up the second part there. But stand for 20 years, that's the thing. And so maybe they're going to get their wish and go back after all. But that slippery slope or that mission creep or whatever, it's already going. And you know how this works. Yes, sir, Mr. President, we'll send a detachment of Delta Force guys right now. Oh, by the way, we're going to need an entire Army division to accompany them, you know, to cook them breakfast and to make sure their bullets are full of explosive powder and stuff. So, you know, can't send drones without Apache helicopters. Can't send Apache helicopters without all the maintenance guys and all the fuel and all of that, all the spare parts and all of those guys. And so they need force protection, another few thousand guys. And we can't just put a few thousand guys in there without having a few thousand more there to protect the few thousand guys that we got there. And, you know, at this point, now you're talking about you need permanent F-16 patrols. Make sure to keep all the bad guys back. And you see how it's like George Bush talked about in the Downing Street memo. Option A is the running start. No, I guess option A was the one that they used. Option B was the running start. Go ahead, get a U-2 shot down. Pretend it was, you know, deliberately bait Saddam into shooting it down. Pretend it was a UN plane and use that as the excuse to just go ahead and start the war with what we've got. We'll just start the air war right now. The rolling start, and then we'll just continue to build up our forces and continue to invade more and more. This is, of course, sounds like Doug Feith talking or something. This is the kind of thing that made the generals want to throw that guy out the window. You know what we could do? We could just invade with like 6,000 guys, and then you guys can catch up after that. And the Pentagon says, no. Remember Shinseki? This is how Shinseki, the guy who recently got canned from the VA for letting your grandpa die, he's the guy that said, no way, we're not doing this without 300,000 guys. And they canned him. Because literally people like Feith and Wolfowitz were calling shots and coming up with schemes. Really, I couldn't make this up. Where, yeah, we'll just invade with 5,000 guys. And then, you know, catch up. Anyway, rolling start. That's what they called it. Option B. Didn't happen that way. But anyway, point being, that's what we're looking at right now, isn't it? And, you know, I don't know, the black robe and the black hat, that makes, has all kind of symbolic reference for the Shia, that this guy, for the Sunni, that this guy is claiming to be the heir of the authority of this, that, and the other guy from the past and all that. But boy, does it make a scary looking costume for American TV. Put that guy up there and turn it into a scaremonger campaign. Whoop everybody up and say, here's your new enemy. Man, he's scarier looking than Bin Laden, probably. Bin Laden kind of had that serenity about him, which was also kind of scary in a psychopathic sort of a way. This guy looks like he's mean as hell, though, you know? Scarier looking than Saddam. I was actually sitting here this morning thinking, man, I wish they would shut up about this guy who murdered his son, and I wish they would shut up about the damn rain, and I wish they would shut up about whatever crap and get to the news. And then I thought, wait a minute, actually, I think maybe go ahead and keep talking about the guy that murdered his son. Apparently, I don't know. According to a lot of claims that the government made about him, I don't know. But anyway, maybe I prefer that they're not talking a lot about Iraq right now, because maybe if they really were talking about Iraq right now, then that would mean they're lying us into war big time. They're drumming up the big push. And then again, I'm not watching Fox. I should have been watching Fox this morning. Anyway, more news, interviews coming up on the show. ScottHorton.org, LRN.FM. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're 1 ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the back side. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code commodity disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's commoditydiscs.com. I'm writing a note. Hey, I'm Scott. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest on the show today is Empty Wheel, Marcy Wheeler. And that's her blog, emptywheel.net, and that's her handle on Twitter, too. You ought to follow her on there. Hey, Marcy, how are you? Oh, I hit the wrong dang button. I always do that. Hey, Marcy, how are you?
I'm still good. Don't hit the wrong button.
Oh, good. I guess you said good back in when the wrong button was hit.
Well,
I'm glad you got a chance to say it twice then. Hey, listen, I appreciate you joining me on the show this morning, especially on the short notice and all that. Big news. Barton Gellman's latest at the Washington Post. NSA intercepted data. In NSA intercepted data, those not targeted far outnumber the foreigners who are. That's a funny definition of the word targeted, then, I guess. I'll have to let you explain what you think about all this.
Yeah, we finally get to know what this wacky definition of target means in real life. Basically, what happened in the stash of documents that Snowden had given Gellman, there was a collection of 160,000 communications that spanned from 2009 to 2012, and it provided the Washington Post to do what, in fact, PCLOB recommended last week that the FISA court do, which is that you get a subsample of the data actually collected under Section 702, and you see what's actually done under the targeting and minimization procedures that are supposed to rein in this practice.
Wait, the PCLOB is what now?
Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, which is a it's a presidential organization that's supposed to watch out for our civil liberties, which issued kind of a weak sauce report last week, but which did raise questions about how much U.S. person data was being collected as part of 702. And now Bart Gellman and his colleagues at Washington Post have given us an answer. And the answer is, that about 90% of the data that's collected under Section 702 is non-target people, and that is both foreigners and Americans. B, in the sample they looked at, something like close to half were Americans. So in some legal documents, they say, well, it would be speculation to say that we're collecting a lot of Americans. Maybe it's just foreigners talking to each other. Apparently not. I mean, apparently, at least in the sample that Gellman looked at, close to half are Americans. What they showed, and this is basically, everyone has said this program is cool because there are these, I'm going to call them government agency protocols, because that's what Chief Justice John Roberts called them when he said they were inadequate and not what the founders had fought a revolution for. They use targeting rules and minimization rules that are supposed to stand in for things like a warrant. And what Gellman's analysis showed, or the Washington Post, because he had some great colleagues work with him on this, and it took 4 months to do this analysis, what it showed was that, what PCLOB reported last week and what government witness after government witness have claimed about their foreignness designation. In other words, before they collect somebody under Section 702, they're supposed to make an argument that this person is overseas. And what the Washington Post found is that, in fact, they're using things like, if you write emails in a foreign language, you must be overseas. If you're in a buddy list of somebody who's overseas, you must be overseas. they were using IP addresses, which of course is not very useful. So in other words, their foreignness designation is not as rigorous as PCLOB and a bunch of government witnesses have claimed. So that's the first problem. That means all these people who've rubber stamped this program have been misled. The second, even more important one for Americans, that last one affects everyone, is that the minimization procedures NSA uses require them to, when they look at a they look at a communication that involves a U.S. person. If it doesn't have significant foreign intelligence purpose, they're supposed to get rid of it. So in other words, if, you know, if they intercept me and my father-in-law talking about how rainy it is this year in Ireland, they're supposed to get rid of that. But what Gelman, what the Washington Post analysis showed, and this is an area where the Washington Post and Pete Klob's analysis completely coincides, is that they're keeping a lot of crap. They're keeping a lot of very personal information, doctor's reports, kids' pictures, people posing in the half-nude, love letters. They're keeping a lot of stuff that is simply not foreign intelligence information as we would understand it. Now, NSA is going to say, well, you know, it'll be useful to find that guy's girlfriend when we want to infiltrate him. And that's probably why they're keeping it. But what that means is that the level for retaining information involving U.S. persons is far lower than the required minimization procedures would have you believe. So in other words, mm-hmm. the FISA court has bought off on these minimization procedures that says you have to throw out communications that have no foreign intelligence purpose. And the Washington Post even quoted some analysts going, oh yeah, this is, they don't say this is crap, but they basically said this is more crap. There are 53 things that were irrelevant here and yet keeping it, you know, so mm-hmm. they're judging that it's irrelevant, but nevertheless, they're keeping this documentation. And that's one of the really important points to this, is that what the Washington Post showed is that the assurances given to Congress and given to Pete Klob and given to the American people are, in fact, wrong.
Right. And now, I guess it does. It comes down to not just the term useful, which not useful for counterterrorism, but useful for intelligence. That just means, you know, there's any fact in there that they decide themselves is interesting to them, basically, is it, right?
Or might be interesting 5 years down the road.
Right, but and only as defined by them.
Right, right. And that's the point, is that the bar set here is so low, and one of the reasons, and as P. Klob explained it, one of the reasons they were concerned about this is because right now, especially the CIA and FBI, and to a lesser extent the NSA, can go back and do these backdoor searches. And they can say, I want to see what Scott Horton has said to people overseas that he's been talking with. And it could include data that's about your family life, right? Which is not intelligence, not foreign intelligence information at all. But down the road, they may use it to squeeze you and make you inform on your friends or what, something like that. I mean, that's the kind of thing that's completely feasible, mm-hmm. given what we know about these programs. Not supposed to happen, but completely within the scope of what could happen, given both what P. Klob had said and especially what Washington Post now has reported.
Yeah, and now, so this is where we get to the real Orwellian nightmare there, like Frank Church put it back in the 1970s. If they ever took their spying apparatus that we have unleashed against the world and turned it inward, there would be nowhere to hide. It would be, and this is, we've already seen a taste of this, and we don't even know how widespread it is, right? About the NSA collecting information and saying, oh, we figured out that we think this guy's, you know, dealing drugs. So let's, you know, launder the information and turn it over to the federal police or the state police or the local sheriff's department. And then they do that parallel construction. You guys make up an excuse for knowing what you know. Perjure yourself in your affidavits on this case, but here it is. But so we're only one step away from, or maybe we're not even there, maybe we're already a half step into, they can just go ahead and outright turn over their entire, you know, their entire haul, their entire intelligence collection on the American people in the name of protecting us from foreign threats, and just turn all of that over to the cops. And just think about what all could be learned in data mining, all of that stuff. Again, like you're talking about, not necessarily criminal stuff, but who's screwing who? That's not, you know, adultery's not a crime anymore, but you sure can control somebody big time with information like that. Oh man, and now a dang commercial break. I'm sorry. When we come back, we're going to talk more about our totalitarian nightmare with our good friend Marcy Wheeler from EmptyWheel.net. That's her great blog, EmptyWheel.net. Back in just a second. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys. Thanks for hanging in there through the break. We're back with Marcy Wheeler, Empty Wheel, they call her online, emptywheel.net. And also, that's her handle on Twitter, too. And I'm sorry, I rant and raved right up to the break, as I sometimes do. Okay, often. About how what you're talking about here, the FBI has access to the NSA's haul on the American people, which they can go fishing through and find evidence of three felonies a day on all 300 million of us, and then we all live in Fahrenheit 451 or worse, totalitarian slavery. What about that?
It's not good. Yeah, I mean, and they don't have numbers. That's the other thing we learned in the last, gosh, has it been a week? The FBI doesn't actually count how many times they do backdoor searches. So there's, you know, generally when in government they don't count something, it means there's a reason they don't want you to know how much they're doing.
Well, and, you know, when they did count, for example, how often they abuse their national security letter authority, the chief of the FBI went before the Congress and says, oh, yeah, we abuse a hell out of those. And I don't remember the numbers, but I believe it was thousands of times that he was happy to admit to even.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if they're. I mean, look, one of the things that they make clear is these databases are accessible to FBI agents. They're in the database where they search on whatever kind of information they have about somebody they're doing an assessment on, which means even if it's somebody who hasn't been trained on FISA material, they can go get somebody and say, hey, what about this foreign conversation that got sucked up? And they'll have access to it. And so it's going to be readily accessible, and they're going to, you know, be able to at least consider that. They may not want to introduce it into court, but, you know, it's all there. It's all of these conversations that we have. Now, we should say that there are limits to the FBI doesn't get everything that NSA gets. They probably get a bunch of their counterterrorism stuff. They probably get a bunch of their cybersecurity stuff, but they don't get, you know, they don't necessarily get the U.S. listening on the Venezuelan president's sex talk. So that's going to limit it. But nevertheless, that's a whole bunch of people. And so if you talk to anybody who might be considered a foreign hacker, then you're in trouble. If you talk to anybody who might know somebody who is a Muslim who is opposed to the United States, you might be in trouble.
Well, it sounds like if you just talk to your spouse while they're on a business trip overseas, then it's open season on your entire email server and everything, no?
Well, it's possible. My spouse is not an American citizen, so yeah, they could easily do that because he's not. I guess he's a U.S. person, so he'd be protected overseas. But if I talk to my in-laws in Ireland, presumably they would have to have a reason to wiretap my in-laws. Mm-hmm. Besides trying to reverse target me, and they're sweet people. I don't know what they'd come up with, but they could probably come up with something, you know.
But then again, I mean, that's all the emphasis on the word they would have to do this or that, but they don't really have to do anything, apparently.
Right, exactly.
So is it just did Snowden pick a certain batch, or do you think that this is a pretty representative sample, that 90% of the haul here are non-targets, that 50% of it has to do with Americans on one end somewhere?
It's tough to tell. It's actually a pretty small fraction of what's out there, and it's what the NSA would get. The Washington Post hinted at some of the things that are covered in there that the NSA was able to get to Al Qaeda related people in Pakistan and Abbottabad leading up to Osama bin Laden's capture. They discussed a nuclear program overseas, which is probably more Iranian targeting. They discussed one of our purported friends double dealing with us. There is that topic base seems fairly broad. It's not just counterterrorism information. It's not just hacking information. They definitely had some of that as well. So it seems topic-wise fairly representative of what the NSA might look at, which is, again, separate from what the FBI would look at. Mm-hmm. And the other thing to be that it's important, I mean, some crazy people online are saying, oh my gosh, what a horrible civil liberties violation it is that Edward Snowden passed on minimized U.S. person data to people who then wrote a report on it, further minimizing the U.S. person data.
And they don't realize
the irony, which is that they have been arguing for a year that minimization was adequate protections for Americans, and yet this data being passed on is somehow this horrible civil liberties violation. And it may well be a concern, although, you know, these days I trust Washington Post more than I trust the CIA, go figure.
Well,
although
they're
increasingly the same, given that Jeff Bezos owns them. But nevertheless, if it's inadequate if it's bad for Snowden to have passed this on, then those people can no longer argue that minimization is adequate protection for Americans because their entire argument fails if Snowden was wrong for having done that.
Right. And then, of course, this is exactly what he's been saying all along, and Snowden is quoted elaborating in the article as explaining, see, this is what I was talking about when I was telling you that I had stuff that the reporters needed to see to understand way more than I could publish online at WikiLeaks or something like that, that I could never release to people, but I could release it to Bart Gellman because he's a responsible journalist and he's going to do the work and then publish the part you need to know without betraying the secrets within, the real private data within. And then, of course, we see that's exactly what happened in the article. A four-month investigation leading to a serious piece of journalism that doesn't betray anyone.
And again, the FISA court judge, John Bates, once asked NSA to figure out how much U.S. person data they have. They refused to do so. Congress, of course, refuses to do any kind of real oversight. PCLOB recommended something similar to what the Washington Post did. So what the Washington Post did is a public service akin to what has been necessary for this program for a very long time. And, you know, hopefully the NSA will go back and pull a sampling that they claim is really really representative, and then they can do their own study, or preferably somebody like PCLOB can do their own study, and we'll know who to distrust. But one thing's very clear coming out of this is that the NSA is keeping far more data than the minimization procedures that purportedly make this constitutional allow them to do. And that should be, I mean, PCLOB kind of poo-pooed this. They said, well, yeah, whatever. But if they're not following the minimization procedures, they're not doing what the court has approved, which is the basis for it being constitutional.
Right. And then, of course, like you're saying, the targeting, too, where they're saying, oh, well, if you're writing your email in a foreign language, then you must live in a foreign country. Are you kidding me? I mean, there are 300 million people in this country, and I don't know what the proportion of them it is that don't speak English as their first language, but it's a hell of a lot of them.
Well, there were other violations in here. They showed that after traditional warrants had been shut down, or the judge, they have deadlines, the judge wouldn't reauthorize it, so they just moved it to Section 702. That's a violation. That's, again, the kind of thing the FBI was doing and gotten a lot of trouble for with the NSLs, with the national security letters. Well, apparently the NSA is doing the same thing, and it's arbitraging the various authorities it can use to go get this data.
Right. And then, of course, this is sort of a side point. You wrote sort of a side blog entry about it, but it is important that they denied that Snowden had access to this kind of information. And here it turns up in the Washington Post. And it is important because, you know, it turns out, happenstance, Ed Snowden is an American hero who did all this for all the right reasons. But that doesn't mean that everybody at NSA with the same kind of access as him has all the same motivations that he has.
Yeah, no one should have ever believed Keith Alexander. I mean, A, they shouldn't have believed him because he always lies. But B, they should never have believed those claims unless what Alexander was saying is he has no clue. And the reason that's true, and this is something I've been writing about for over a year, is that tech people, people like Edward Snowden, are in many different situations given unaudited access to raw data. I mean, that is the way the NSA works. The tech people need to do it to get their algorithms working, and they and then tech people are allowed to, play around with their new gimmick gizmo using raw data. And so that means that tech people like Edward Snowden routinely have unaudited access to the raw data that the NSA collects. That's been true. That's been apparent in the phone dragnet order. They still do. Dianne Feinstein tried to codify that with her fake FISA fix last fall. There are a number of other ways that the NSA tech people get access to this. So it is a huge security problem, and Keith Alexander has been hiding that by lying about Edward Snowden's access to it for a year.
Thank you very much for your time on the show again, Marcy. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's the great Marcy Wheeler, everybody. EmptyWheel.net. We'll be right back. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And coming up on the show, Mitchell Prothero will be on. And we're going to talk about the bad news coming out of Iraq. We got a ton of it. But now to Israel news. Do you know the background? You know the story? Three Israeli teenagers were kidnapped and killed. And then the Israeli government said, oh, look, they've been killed. We found the bodies after apparently waiting a week and whooping up all the anger over it. And then they disclosed that, okay, the kids, in fact, were killed. And then the thing of it was, during the week, they weren't just whooping up, pogrom-type sentiment among Israelis. They were raiding the houses, going door-to-door and doing, you know, mass raids on the West Bank in the name of searching for the teenagers. They may very well have already known where they were. And just making life hell for as many people as they possibly could. Collective punishment. Rather than any kind of real search. I mean, give us a break, you know? Everybody sees what's going on. So then they found the bodies and declared they found the bodies. And then the riots began. And one young man was lynched, burnt alive. That means to death. Tortured and murdered. And then his cousin. What's with that? How many Palestinians live on the West Bank again? Or in Ramallah? Or where do these people live? And then his cousin was arrested and beaten mercilessly by Israeli police, and it's all on camera. And it was so funny. CNN's actually covering it a bit, which is amazing, and which is its own news story, really. In fact, maybe I'll get back to that in just a second, the CNN thing. First of all, though, and this really just goes to show, this accomplishes nothing but illustrating the ridiculous bias of the Americans on these issues. When CNN tweeted out, men in Israeli police uniforms beat a young Palestinian. Well, They were in Israeli police uniforms because they were the Israeli police. Notice they're not claiming Palestinians in a false flag attack posing as Israeli police beat up a Palestinian kid just to make poor little Israel look bad. They don't say that, but that's the implication that they would be very happy for you to misunderstand. I mean, why in the world would they point out that they're wearing police uniforms instead of just identifying them as Israeli police unless there's something to that? There's a mystery that has yet to be solved whether these, in fact, were Israeli police, apparently. Is that what you're trying to tell me, CNN? And everyone on Twitter was just completely ridiculing them about it. The entire, every response was, what a joke. Well, these men, these Israelis, dressed as Israeli police because those are the uniforms that their ranking police officers gave them to wear, then arrested this kid and took him down and booked him in the local jail and hauled him before the Israeli judge. So at what point is it no longer a mystery as to whether these guys were actually cops or not? And now, I don't have to be a conspiracy theorist or speculate. It's just obvious. It's as plain as day that whoever was in charge of writing that tweet or the supervisor of whoever tweeted that tweet was trying to fool you with a half-truth and trying to make it seem, to try to imply through some innuendo that this was anything other than the worst case of a foreign government's police brutality on someone who, wasn't just a Palestinian, was a Palestinian-American. And so all of a sudden he's got, like, the rights of 3/5 of a man or something at least. He was below subhuman, right? He was below untouchable a minute ago when he was Palestinian. Now he's a Palestinian-American citizen. Visiting. You know what? He might even be 51% human. And therefore requiring the protection of the U.S. state in some capacity. They were about to deny the kid the ability, and his face, you should see his face if you haven't seen it, what they did to this kid. After they're just holding him down in handcuffs, stomping on his face, kicking him repeatedly and stomping on him, beating the crap out of him. And according to a report in Haaretz, the only reason that they let the kid out on bail and turned him over to his mother was because the judge actually began saying hell no, and then looked up and realized that American consular officials were in the courtroom, and then they went, oh, whoops, politics, and went to let the kid out. And he's telling his side of the story. There's full coverage of this at Electronic Intifada. But now back to what is really the biggest news. Because, hell, they killed Rachel Corrie, and they murdered her, and they murdered Furkan Dogan. And, whoever cared about that? Nobody at CNN, that's for sure. And yet, they're really covering this. And I think that is news in itself, that despite their ridiculous tweet trying to spin away the responsibility here, they are, I would expect them to not cover this at all on CNN. This is amazing to me. I mean, when it came to the murder of Furkan Dogan, they just didn't mention it at all. They portrayed the entire Mavi Marmara thing as, from the Israeli point of view, like it was some invasion of Israel by a bunch of terrorists, you know, armed to the teeth with sticks. That, you know, pieces of railing from their own boat that they defended themselves with when attacked by the Israeli defense, so-called defense forces in international waters. In fact, the only highlight in media of the Mavi Marmara event is that Glenn Greenwald got to talk for a couple of minutes. They brought him on CNN, and it was Elliot Spitzer had a show at that time, and Spitzer had been interviewing Israeli government agents, ambassadors, etc., for half an hour straight or something before they let Greenwald on. So once Greenwald started telling the truth, they tried to interrupt him and shut him up, and Greenwald said, no, You just had half an hour straight of pure government, Israeli government propaganda. And now you're going to sit and listen to me debunk it all. Blammo to you. It's great. You can Google that up, man, and watch the video. And Greenwald just completely destroys their propaganda and talks, you know, and talks all about the inhumanity of the siege that is meant to keep the children of Gaza, quote, on a diet, hungry but not starving. You sick bastards. And Greenwald just destroys them. Because when he says, no, you shut up and let me talk, Spitzer is like, all right, he has to. Because it's just too obvious how desperate he is to try to stop Greenwald from saying what he has to say. So Greenwald makes that desperation the issue. You can have half an hour straight of undiluted Israeli government propaganda and endless edited loop footage in the background. You can sure as hell sit still and listen to me talk for a minute, you bastards. And he shuts Spitzer up and goes on, and it's great. Good old Greenwald. He was great back before Snowden ever leaked him a thing, did you know? He's doing great work there. But anyway, so now there's all kind of riots in Israel. People chanting death to the Arabs. There's now a lynch mob has burnt a young Palestinian kid to death. Six have been arrested. At least Netanyahu is trying to come out squeaky clean on this somehow by saying he's anti the lynching of people, even though he spent a week sending his Shin Bet to do basically that same thing, to destroy everybody's property, terrorize them up and down the West Bank. And as Max Blumenthal pointed out on the show last week, there's every reason to believe, and they've written this up at MondoWeiss.net, there's every reason to believe that they knew these kids were dead all along, the three kidnapped Israelis. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right. You know, I didn't get a chance to ask Marcy Wheeler about this other important NSA story, which is also by Gelman at the Post. Gelman and co-authors. Court gave NSA broad leeway in surveillance, and this is the one that I talked about last week, and it's just about how the NSA said, basically, go ahead and tap the entire world. So, this isn't all directly about us, but it still has a lot of information there. Anyway, emptywheel.net for what all of this stuff means. Oh, I wanted to mention Rand Paul. Now, I'm not going to sit here and rant and rave about Rand Paul today, I hope. I guess it's still possible. But Rand, he wrote a horrible thing about poor little Israel for the National Review and has introduced a new bill to cut off aid to the Palestinian Authority, pretending he doesn't know that American aid to the Palestinian Authority is a favor to Israel. For the Palestinian Authority to keep the people of the West Bank and East Jerusalem under control. That's what General Dayton's army is for, internal suppression. And Mahmoud Abbas, I'm not saying I know every last detail exactly of his rise to power to replace Arafat's assassinated corpse. But basically, he was the American and Israeli agreed-upon guy to be the leader of the PA. I don't know. Phil Weiss, Mondo Weiss, is going to be on the show tomorrow. We can maybe talk with him a little bit more about that. But that's what the PA is. The PA is the American-Israeli sock puppet government over the occupied West Bank. And Rand Paul's characterization of this, in fact, never mind Rand Paul. This isn't even about him. His characterization of what's going on there in the National Review is the characterization of talk radio land in America. And I think, frankly, for the most part, for most Americans, too. In that he calls the Palestinians Israel's neighbors. Israel's neighbors. As though the reason these borders aren't settled is because these guys are in an endless sort of, World War I fight over where the line should be, pushing it back and forth, yards here and yards there, or some kind of construct like that. But it's just not like that. See, the West Bank and East Jerusalem, that's, and never mind Gaza, but yeah, the same thing for Gaza. That is all conquered, occupied territory since 1967. Okay? It would be like if the U.S. Army went across the Rio Grande and conquered and occupied all of Juarez and said, whatever, we're going to start building condos here and screw you guys. And all the people of Juarez were just stuck there and say, oh, and all the surrounding territory too. And they were just stuck under a foreign country's military occupation. Under martial law of a foreign government as their domestic rule permanently. The PA is just an adjunct of that at this point. It's the same thing for Hamas. Hamas are like the prison guards of the Gaza Strip concentration camp. They're under complete blockade. Everything that they buy or sell or trade at all across those borders has to go through Israeli controls. Again, the policy is to keep them hungry but not starving, in the words of the Israeli government, to keep them on a diet, to deliberately malnourish children, at least. That's the nicest way to put it, to deliberately wage a hunger war against a population that is in its majority under the age of 18 years old. And Rand Paul, here's the thing about it. I remember being a stupid little kid. Nobody ever told me about what was going on in Israel at all. All I ever knew was like the vaguest hearsay kind of a thing. And you know how it goes. Oh, come on. It's a religious war. They're always just going to be fighting over who God gave that land to and this, that, and the other thing. And that takes it all into the realm of the magical. And I don't mean to be demeaning to people's beliefs. Into the supernatural, the divine, as opposed to actual real earthly human political things going on here. Like who patrols your neighborhood? Your own domestic martial law or a foreign government's martial law? Or do the two different martial laws work together to enslave you all day and brutalize your family and deny you all dignity and keep it that way for generations on end? These are the questions, not who God gave the land to. The question is, who's occupying who? Who's stealing land from who? And yeah, they did ethnically cleanse all of, so-called Israel proper. But that was at least back in 48, so just by time gone by, you could at least consider that just a fait accompli. Okay, fine, then. That's the state of Israel. It's been tolerable to many of the governments in the region in varying degrees over the years. Assuming that Israel will even deal with them about it. Even Hamas, Satan, they have said that they will recognize the state of Israel at 67 borders. Just end the occupation. Allow them to create a Palestinian state. And they are not pushing for, yes, it still says it in their party platform, but their negotiators, and they're the elected government of Gaza in an election that Condoleezza Rice and Ehud Olmert held there. And who then Elliot Abrams armed them up accidentally, trying to arm up Fatah and the PLA against them, accidentally just ended up getting the guns turned over to Hamas, and Fatah ended up getting kicked right out of the strip. But anyway, the point is they have said they'll recognize Israel. They're not pushing for the uncreation, the dissolution of the state of Israel. They are pushing for a two-state solution. That's what they've said. I saw the Hamas guy in the Charlie Rose show say, we'll recognize Israel. We've been saying that. Arafat said that in 1988. The leader of the PLA in 1988 said, we will recognize Israel in 67 borders. Just let us have the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. I mean, anyway, so that's the issue. And Rand Paul knows better and is deliberately buying into that obfuscation by way of semantics and pretending like there already is somehow some equal sovereign Palestinian state that just continues to wage this war. As though this kidnapping of these three Israelis was across the border by the state government of the West Bank. When that just isn't right. I mean, they were in the occupied territories in the first place, is how they got kidnapped. I'm not saying that justifies it, but I'm just saying he's lying about the circumstances. They're neighbors. That's what they would have you believe. But when you find out who's occupying who, really, then there's just no question as to who's attacking and who's retaliating. They're crying boo-hoo about 20 missiles that hit an empty field in southern Israel over the Gaza prison wall this morning that didn't hurt anyone. Those are retaliation. Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And by the way, screw Hamas, and they shouldn't be shooting rockets at people and whatever. In fact, I don't even think it's probably Hamas doing the shooting of the rockets. And nobody should be shooting rockets at anybody. I'm not saying I'm pro-rocket shooting, but I am saying, hey, it's a hard commercial break. I have to stop talking at some point. It ain't always at an opportune moment. but I am saying that Israel is occupying Palestine and not the other way around. And no, it's not their next door neighbor like Jordan, at least more or less sovereign state, picking a fight with them across their border the way Rand Paul would try to portray it. And you notice how he tries to portray it that way. He just implies it. Oh, they're neighbors. They're Palestinian neighbors. No, the people that they are occupying, whose land they're colonizing and stealing, whose water they're stealing, whose ancient olive groves they're bulldozing, whose homes they're bulldozing, evicting them in the name of zoning code violations from a city where their ancestors have lived for 2,000 years. Oh, yeah, no, I'm sorry, your house isn't up to code. Are you kidding me? Just think of it if it was the other way around. The Palestinians on the Israeli side and the Israeli Jews penned into a giant concentration camp in Gaza and on the West Bank where there are giant separation walls everywhere, separating them from their property, checkpoints everywhere, humiliation, foreign military occupation. Holy crap! You put it like that for one moment. What if somehow the tables were turned? What if I Dream a Genie, did the head bop thing or Bewitched, twinkled her nose or something, and then just blam, all of a sudden all the roles were reversed. And it was all Israeli Jews in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip under the military occupation of the Palestinians. Oh, then you could see ipso facto, right away, immediately, no argument. Who's the victim and who's the perpetrator? Simple as that. Simple as that. All you have to do is be honest with the facts and with equal morality, moral equivalence, you could call it, for just a minute. Who's killing whose babies? Who's occupying whose land? You have your answer. And it doesn't have to be that way. Like I said, virtually every government in the region, although you're going to have to get back with the new premier of the caliphate and all that. But otherwise, virtually every other government in the region has said that they either recognize Israel or they will recognize Israel to at least some degree, you know, Malaysia-level recognition. Rand Paul helps Benjamin Netanyahu move the goalposts in his National Review piece. He says, oh no, you have to declare it's a Jewish state. except for all the Christians and Muslims who live there, right? On any other day, Rand Paul is crying crocodile tears for the Christians of the Middle East at the hands of the radical Islams that at least he does admit U.S. policy unleashed over there. But anyway, oh, he cares so much for the Christians of the Middle East, except if it's, unless they're Israelis, in which case, that's a Jewish state, screw them. They could be third-class citizens, and he doesn't care about that. And by Rand Paul, I mean all Republicans, all conservatives, and a hell of a lot of liberals, too, on this issue. It's ridiculous. It's horrible. It's shameful is what it is. Especially, you know, it's especially shameful for somebody like Rand Paul, who certainly knows better. I mean, what kind of half-baked, half-truth sort of lie by omission is that? Yeah, poor Israel. We're always asking them to restrain themselves when it comes to retaliation against their Palestinian neighbors. Make me sick. And I want to like him for the same reason that the war party hates him. But, yeah, there's a certain level of shamefulness just seems to show that it can only get worse. There can only be more and more and more examples of him acting just like this on any issue. If he'll be this bad on Israel, hell, he said last week he was in favor of bombing Iraq. He said America made it this way, and no, we shouldn't go to war there. We shouldn't send in ground troops, but I guess I'm open to some airstrikes. What are you talking about? Bad on bombing Iraq? Oh, I guess, whatever, just whatever you think Karl Rove would say is good advice for how to get along in the electoral world out there. I'm over it. I don't know what he would have to do now for me to look the other way when it comes to this kind of thing. And I am for cutting off all aid to the Palestinians, but only, well, only... He's the one who made it this argument. We should absolutely, certainly, and most importantly, much more importantly, we should cut off all aid to the Israelis and tell them you're going to have to figure out a way to get by in the world, and we recommend that you come to terms with your neighbors and make peace and end the occupation. But no more free fighter jets, no more free bullets, no more immunity in the UN Security Council by our veto, and... good luck negotiating. You ought to get the hell out of the West Bank while the getting is good. Doesn't belong to you. And then cut off, by all means, cut off aid to the Palestinians. Why should America be paying to build a Palestinian army for the Israeli government to use against the people of Palestine? Wouldn't that be funny if that was what Rand Paul said in his National Review article? It is unconscionable, and we're giving all this aid to the Palestinian Authority. Because, in fact, all we're doing is we're paying a proxy army of the Israelis for the oppression of the innocent civilians of the West Bank that the Israelis call Samaria as though it belongs to them and continue to colonize, continue to expand their colonies on a regular basis. Why should America pay for that? Now, there's a National Review article by Rand Paul that I could get behind. What a bummer, man. Oh, I know. He's so ambitious. Gotta get that power. Gotta get that power. Oh, he's just like Barack Obama. You can believe every liberal in 2007 and 2008. I know he's actually completely horrible on Afghanistan and Pakistan and Somalia and a lot of other things. But you know what? He's just pretending to be evil because he has to play that game. He has to be tougher than Israel, than Hillary Clinton. A little bit of a Freudian slip there. He has to be tougher on Hillary Clinton, tougher than Hillary Clinton on Pakistan. But once he's president, you'll see he's secretly an angel. He's not going to kill anybody. That's what they're saying about Rand right now. He's got to play that game. It's third-dimensional chess. He's got to protect his right flank from the criticism of the Israel lobby. But don't worry. Really, at the end of the day, they said with Obama, look at his skin. He's really a regular guy like us. with Rand. They say, look at his last name. He's really a regular guy like us. And yet here's a guy who's been saying blatantly out loud, I am perfectly happy to make a deal with the devil for the chance at power since the moment he began running for Senate. Oh, I would be honored to be named to Paul Ryan's losing spot on the Romney ticket. Oh, please. Jesus, man, would you calm down a little? Somebody hold him back. I would be honored to throw my father under the bus for a, what, 10% chance that Romney would name him vice presidential running mate? Boy, if that wasn't the most sickening display. Anyway, I better change the subject now. I still want Ron to like me. I'm afraid that people are going to say, man, that Scott Horton sure does hate your boy. And then he's going to not like me anymore because he's got to love his boy. It's his boy, right? You know, but I love Ron Paul and I want him to like me. I admit it. Rand, what a disappointment. All right. Oh, by the way, in the top of the hour news on this show, great. The FPP and Liberty Beat news. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton, this is the show. Yeah, I wanted to make sure and mention that. I feel real lucky that I'm no longer stuck with Fox News or any of this other crap. I've got the Liberty Beat and I've got the FPP news at the top of the hour breaks here every day. And they're great, aren't they great? We got the best damn top of the hour news in the history of radio. I mean, top of the hour news on radio sucks, man. And the best you're going to get is just, you know, straight news, but obviously, you know, with the Empire slant from CBS top of the hour, ABC top of the hour, that's at least, you know, has quality in some aspects to it. But no, I love this stuff, man. Liberty Beat and FPP radio news. This stuff's great. All right. Yeah, so I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up here in just a few minutes, we're going to be talking with Mitchell Prothero about his new piece, Out of Iraq, on the Rise of the Islamic State, and Big Daddy, who gave his big speech from the balcony. Did you see the pictures of this guy? Jesus. At the Friday prayers last week, and Mitchell's got quite a write-up here. McClatchyDC.com for you. So we're going to get to that here in just a few. Let me talk about the F-35. I've been telling y'all about the F-35. They've just wasted trillions on this thing already. Well, hundreds of billions, I guess. What do they say? Half a trillion or something? I don't know. But the whole project is supposed to just keep costing that much, too. And here's the joke. The plane is a joke. And it always has been. And everybody's always known this. I first heard of the F-22s and the F-35s as these sort of white elephant projects that were created, that were thought of at least back in the late 80s for fighting the future, the Soviet Union, stealth MiG fighters of the 21st century. Except for the Soviet Union quit existing 9 years before the end of the 20th century. And so they just kept on anyway. I first heard of this way back in the 90s. They're doing this anyway. And the whole thing is they're not stealthy. They're not that fast. The wings are so small because it's got to be able to take off straight up from the ground, according to the Marine Corps, that then it's hardly got any lift. And so it's not that maneuverable. 60 Minutes did a big apologia for the damn thing a few weeks ago, and the best thing that they could say about it is it's packed full of cameras and sensors and electronics, but you can just pack all those sensors into an F-15. It's not stealthy. It was, I always get her name wrong. It was, oh, come on, Brain. Somebody just corrected me about this the other day, too. Oh, man, I'm sorry. I forget my great interviewee's name who talked about how all they got to do is use old school radar like the British had in World War II. And that's what the Russians are doing. They're using their long wave radar. And then, oh, there's your stealth plane. How'd they shoot down that F-117 over Serbia? Long wave radar. Yeah. Oh, we can't see anything. Twist the dial a little bit to the left. Oh, there it is. That's your stealth. The plane's a joke. And you could buy fleets and fleets and fleets. And I'm not saying you need a world empire. But I'm just saying, all things being equal, you could buy fleets of F-15s and F-16s, F-18 Hornets for your Navy, and all of that for the cost of just one of these things. You could buy four or five other planes that actually already are proven effective. And the F-15, I guess, was a turkey for a long time. They finally got it up to something like it was supposed to be. You can watch this great video. Oh, and by the way, yeah, so the engine blew up and they're all grounded. The F-35s are all grounded right now. The same thing for the British. They had a major accident recently, or I don't think anybody was killed, but they had a major problem with the plane, with the engine, and they've now grounded their F-35s too. You know, America's forcing all their partners with a gun to their head to buy all these things all around the world, and they're pieces of crap. Piece of crap. There's a thing on Dig. I tweeted this out too. I should have posted on my blog. But there's a great, if you just, here's what you do. You can Google search really easy for designer F-15 F-35. And then blam, it'll come right up. Designer F-15 F-35. And what it is it's the designer of the F-15 talking about the F-35. He talks bad about the F-15, too. He says, yeah, they made me design the damn F-15, which I hated, but I did anyway and did as best I could. But then me and my rogue crew, we broke away from that project and designed the F-16, which actually works and is actually cheap and effective and is a bomber and a fighter and whatever you need for killing people with and all of that. So that's his position anyway, this Lockheed engineer. But then he goes to tell the story of the F-35, and it's a Canadian journalist interviewing him. And she's just incredulous. She's like, wait a minute, but so are you really telling me it's not stealthy, it's not fast, it's not maneuverable, it costs, you know, this much money, it's almost impossible to maintain in the field, it's, you know, it's unworkable, it's, you know, presumed mission as a Marine jump jet, you know, that's useful in any short time period or anything like that. It's completely off the table. You're telling me this plane is worthless. The most expensive fighter, the most expensive government project since, I don't know, whenever. Since the New Deal. To build a damn F-35. That's a piece of crap. And the same thing goes for the F-22. It was Robert Gates that said the F-22 is worthless. And they're stopping making them finally. There was a jobs program. Save our jobs, making F-22s to kill people with. They cried. And so they found some, I think the Israelis bought some, and maybe the Japanese. They found a few more foreign buyers. But I think now finally that F-22 line is finally shutting down. But it was even Robert Gates was saying the F-22 is worthless. What are we going to do? Fight a war with China? No. And even then, again, swarms of F-15s and F-16s, way cheaper for the task if it comes down to a fight for air supremacy over Russia or China or some absolute worst-case scenario like that. You still F-22s suck. What are you talking about? And poor Robert Gates is saying, look, man, my job is bombing Afghan civilians to death on the ground. I don't need an F-22, I need an F-35, which presumably can drop a bomb, you know, maybe one or two. You gotta, it's, a, to pretend it's stealthy, you gotta keep all the bombs on the inside, so you can only bring one or two small bombs. Completely worthless for, you know, air support for ground troops. It's meant to replace the A-10, except that the A-10, you can fly low and slow and look out the window and see who you're killing. But with the F-35, nope, if you fly low and slow, you'll fall out of the sky. And so, yeah, you got to go really, really fast and drop your bomb and close your eyes real tight and hope that you don't just blow away all the American soldiers that you're trying to protect from the civilians who are shooting back at them. Anyway, complete piece of crap. They're now costing up to $500 million a piece, and that's got to be a lie, right? It's got to be more than that. And the critics of the F-35 have been around for 15 years and getting it right this whole time. And no one has an excuse for this thing going on. The only thing, in fact, if there is only, it's no excuse at all, but if there's a silver lining, it's to show you that, see, this is what Obi-Wan Kenobi calls the economics of politics. Lockheed pays men to represent them in Congress. They go to Congress and then they appropriate money from the Treasury to Lockheed. There you go. The economics of politics. That's how it works. There's the secret society that you've been looking for, the evil conspiracy that rules America. It's the Congress. They're the ones. And that's how Lockheed gets it done. That's how Archer Daniels Midland gets it done. That's how AARP and everybody and Israel and everybody else gets it done too. They send their representatives to the Congress to take money, to hold guns to people's heads to get their work done. And in fact, this designer of the F-15, again, your search terms in your favorite brand search engine, you don't have to use Google, whatever you like, just search for designer F-15 F-35. The lady asks him, if this plane is good for nothing, then what is it good for? And he says, oh, this is actually the real mission of the plane. It's to transfer money from the American people to Lockheed. That is the plane's mission. So you see right there, in the economics of politics, it's good that the engine's broken and they got to redesign it. More money for Lockheed. See? The economics of politics. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Alright, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We're on the Liberty Radio Network and ScottHorton.org. Join up the chat room if you want, ScottHorton.org/chat. Follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show, etc., etc. Alright, so, again, major developments in the case of the Islamic State. Last Friday, the leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, a.k.a. some other things, the new declared caliph, apparently led Friday prayers at a very important old mosque in Mosul. And on the line with us is McClatchy's guy in Baghdad right now, in Iraq, in Erbil, Iraq, Mitchell Prothero. And his headline is, Islamic State releases video of Baghdadi in Mosul in new assertion of authority. Welcome back to the show, Mitchell. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Doing pretty good. Just enjoying the extremely hot, dry, and dusty weather we have here in the Islamic Caliphate.
It's a dry heat.
It only feels like 110.
Oh, yeah, there you go. That's heat. Not too bad. All right,
but
so,
actually, jokes aside, you know, Erbil is part of the autonomous region of Kurdistan. Mm-hmm. They've recently decided that they really don't need any more of this nonsense from the Arabs and are going independent. So, you know, I'm only about probably 30 miles from what we would technically call the Islamic Caliphate.
All right, right on the edge there. Well, make sure you have some Peshmerga between you and them at all times, please, if you can. I assume that's one of your priorities, right?
Well, you know, yeah, they do a good job. You know, the Pesh have, they've been fighting in these mountains for about, 1,000 years against just about everybody. So in terms of local security services, they do a good job, but I do worry they're a little overconfident. It's been a long time since the Arabs or even the Turks had security forces that could handle them. So, you know, these guys are a new breed that we've got here in the Islamic Caliphate, and they're tough guys. And I think the reason why Erbil has been quiet is because they've been concentrating on other things to the south. Namely, what we saw today is a lot of fighting around the infamous Baghdad suburb of Abu Ghraib. And, you know, honestly, if the Islamic State and their tribal allies manage to push any closer to Baghdad in that direction, you start seeing Baghdad International Airport coming under mortar fire, being shut off. And at that stage, we can almost start saying Baghdad is under siege.
Well, and speaking of which, the road to the airport from Baghdad is, what, 30 miles a highway there?
No. Baghdad to the airports, it was known as the Route of Death. It's probably from what they'd call the Green Zone, International Zone. I think it's about 5 miles, less than 10 kilometers.
Oh, okay.
What you're talking about is on the airports are always very big. The mortar attack that killed the Iraqi army general that is in command of the Western defenses, and he did die today, we confirmed that, his headquarters was about 10 miles from Baghdad. So that gives you some idea of how close these guys are getting. If they were able to continue to push in and hold those positions with some of that heavy artillery that the Americans bought the Iraqi army that they then left for the Islamic State, Baghdad International Airport could be within a week or so of being in some real trouble. I don't know if they could actually take it over, but they certainly can make it so that planes can't take off and land.
Right. Well, and even just a few good mortar strikes on that highway puts it out of commission and makes that very hard to repair in no security type environment.
Well, that's inside. I mean, when you're looking at straight inside Baghdad, right now what we've seen is the militias that have flooded in to support Maliki. You know, a lot of these guys in some ways are very good, and they're very good at defending their neighborhoods. So we've yet to see a situation in which significant parts of Baghdad have popped up into open insurrection. That's sort of what we're all waiting for, in a strange way. There's a strong belief that the Islamic State has sleeper cells. I mean, I don't even know if you want to call them sleeper cells, but Sunni neighborhoods throughout particularly western Baghdad have begun to show signs that they're ready to join an uprising when the time is right. And so while internal security, I'm told, I'm not in there, I am up in the north, but a lot of my colleagues and friends are down there. I'm on the phone every day. Life is tense but normal, but everybody knows, as they'd say in the old movies, you know, the Indians are circling around the wagon train right now, and it could only be a matter of time before some of these neighborhoods go, and then we'll simply have to assess where you can go and where you can't go. Just, you know, in terms of people who want to geek out over maps, my suggestion would be to look at the neighborhoods called Jihad and Amaria, which do link the airport road to the rest of the country. Both of those have had long histories of insurgencies. And there's a Sunni neighborhood just to the sort of southern part of the city called Dora, which itself, I think, is a place where we might be seeing some action coming up. But again, it's a matter of when. I think they're capable of doing it now. They just really might be waiting to position their forces and coordinate things in a smart manner. Mm-hmm. These guys might be nuts, but we've seen them be very, very smart tactically.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you wrote about last week this article about how they brought on Baathist military tacticians, real professional soldiers, to come in and run this thing. So the front lines can be school shooters, but they better do what they're told, I guess, by the bosses, huh?
Look, they might have started as school shooters, but you're talking 2-3 years ago, and these guys have been fighting in Syria, and they had, you know, wide open training camps where nobody really could disturb them, as we've learned, in the desert outside of Mosul, and the desert on the other side of the border that apparently only means something now to the maps. These guys don't see the border between Syria and Iraq anymore, outside of Raqqa. So what, you know, while they were easily dismissed early on, and I'm starting to take issue even with some of my colleagues and analysts who say things like these guys are only capable of chopping off heads on videos, they're only capable of doing things like terrorist, you know, suicide bombings, and that they're using the media to terrify people. All of those things are true. They do live off their reputation to a certain extent. They are scary and brutal, and I sure as heck don't want to run into them on the street. But it's very condescending at this stage to say that they are not a competent military force. They're about the most competent non-government military force in the region. I'd put them, if they're not as good as Hezbollah, who's been fighting the Israelis for 30-odd years, and prior to this, I'd say was absolutely the best. They're coming close in some ways to that level of internal organization and military competence. These guys might have been school shooters, but now they've had 2 years of fighting, training, and as my friend joked when they brought in the Baathists, now they've got bureaucrats and clerks to help run everything.
Yeah. Well, and as you pointed out on the show before, they've won a world historical victory over the Iraqi army here in the way that they routed them and just kicked them completely out of the north and west of the country and drove them back all the way to Baghdad like that in the space of a week. I mean, that is pretty unprecedented. That's making the books one way or the other, no matter what.
Well, so, I'm calling it. I mean,
you can see why they're proud.
Well, yeah, they are. The one thing is, I do think they're being a little cocky. We've seen them overstate because, again, this is where the stuff really gets into the weeds, but the weeds are where the truth can really sit. The fact is, you're talking about a 10,000-man group that spans two countries as we see it, but they call it their own caliphate. These are the guys that are trained and organized and equipped by what used to be ISIS or the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. Their commanders, we've learned now over time, are a core of hardened Iraqi jihadists. They have foreigners inside, but they also have a good number of Syrians and Iraqis, and that's what we call the vanguard. But 10,000 guys, even as good as they are, really couldn't run amok like this. With the biggest problem that in a lot of ways the Iraqi government, as it, in my opinion, completely flounders incompetently, almost to the point the international community doesn't want to get involved because you can't back people this incompetent. It's simply throwing bad money after bad money. But what we're seeing is they have more than that. Whether it's that the Sunni tribes throughout a large chunk of, you know, what we'd say eastern Syria, western, northern, and central Iraq actually want to live under an Islamic caliphate, I don't know. But right now they're fighting alongside.
All right, hang tight. 1 second. We got to take this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Mitchell Prothero from McClatchy Newspapers reporting from Erbil, Iraq. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Mitchell Prothero from McClatchy Newspapers. He's been writing some really great stuff. This one is called Islamic State Releases Video of Baghdadi in Mosul, in New Assertion of Authority. And I forget the title of the one before that, but that had all kinds of stuff about Nusra, basically swearing loyalty over to ISIS. Back on the other side of what used to be the line, I guess we can say over there in Western Islamic State now instead of Eastern Syria. Lots of great stuff here. McClatchyDC.com is how you read Mitchell Prothero, reporting from Erbil, Iraq. And now, let me talk about the siege real quick. I want to ask you all about everything that you learned about the new, Big Daddy, the leader over there. As you report here, Mitchell. But first, when you mentioned the siege, I want to get back to something that you had said. You had reported this back, I don't know, a week and a half or two ago now, about ISIS, at least pressure or disruption, something on highways to the south, and I think to the southeast, leading out of Baghdad toward Basra, that ISIS had been able to get that far. And you mentioned earlier about laying siege in the context of the airport, which I believe is out to the west, right of Baghdad. So what's the latest on that? Have you heard further developments on ISIS's move to the south and east there?
Well, again, if you start looking at it the way that I do, which is that there's this sort of vanguard of guys who move around who are highly trained and well-equipped, what they do is they come in and they hit areas at the exact time that the Sunni tribes who are livid at Maliki, and feel like the government oppresses them sort of rise up in a coordinated effort. So suddenly 500 guys in pickup trucks mounted with heavy machine guns really make a difference because they've got locals helping them.
Right.
What we've seen is what I'd call more probing attacks. There's a handful of towns back in the good old bad days of the American occupation of Iraq. It was called the Triangle of Death. But there's these towns called Iskandaria, Mahmoudia in this area that control the highways leading out of Baghdad to the south. Those have heavy Sunni populations. And in multiple occasions, they've done what I'm starting to feel like were testing attacks. How strong are the, you know, how strong are the security forces? How seriously are they going to be able to, you know, stop us? But we've yet to see the what I'd call a primary move from this what we're calling the shock troops of the Islamic State. Mm-hmm. I would anticipate that to be the sign that Baghdad's going to be formally under siege. But we just haven't seen it yet. It seems like they're concentrating their efforts the best they can. To the west, there's still some parts of Ramadi that are in government control. And there's a big dam at Haditha that controls the hydroelectric power for Al-Anbar. And from what I can tell, there's still some guys, some government guys hold up inside that. So, you know, it's step by step. Again, they're very methodical and they're very logical. And I think I've identified their plan, but I have to say they're so sophisticated. They might be setting us all up to think they're going to do something and then surprise us with something else. I just don't know. But as of right now, you can drive between Baghdad and the south. I just don't know how long you're going to be able to. Mm-hmm.
And right now, is the Iraqi army getting it together, preparing for their big assault, or this is really the best they can do right now?
The Iraqi army's, I mean, it's a mess. There are elite units that are pretty good. These were trained by American Special Forces. They had some long history of having to fight Al-Qaeda, but they're small. These are what we call, you know, special operations troops. Those guys aren't bad. As for the standard Iraqi army, it's really collapsed. And so as a result, they've had to bring in these militias, a lot of which fought either Sunnis in the past. Some were fighting in Syria up until last month. And others, if not all of them, had fought the Americans themselves at one time or another. They've done a lot of the bolstering job from what we can tell. So they're in the process of sort of rebuilding an army around this. But at McClatchy and some other news organizations, there were some background briefings with U.S. intelligence and military officials who gave one of the best assessments, clear-eyed, I've ever seen the U.S. military give about Iraq, in which they basically told us there's very little chance that this government can put together an army that will be able to retake the ground that it's lost. The actual fall of Baghdad seems unlikely. There's just too many Shia in it. They've all got Kalashnikovs, and they're all ready to die to protect their homes. The militias are pretty good at fighting in their own neighborhoods. But in terms of the idea that there's going to be an Iraqi army that forms and with tanks and air support drives up that highway and retakes Tikrit and lifts the siege at the refinery and retakes Mosul, that could happen, I guess, but it ain't going to happen this year.
Yeah, with a lot of American and Iranian help, maybe.
Well, I mean, that's the thing that at this stage, and something I wanted to say, the Americans, from what we can tell, again, just don't seem inclined to throw in a tremendous amount of support at this stage. And they won't come out exactly and say it, but it's pretty obvious is they think Maliki's done. They think that the political process here needs to come up with a much smarter solution. And only then are they going to start possibly risking some more blood and treasure to help these guys out. If right. somebody's incompetent and gets themselves into this mess and continues to be that incompetent, how inclined to help them are you going to be?
Right. And now, see, we're so short on time and there's two major questions there. But I guess I have to ask, based on what you just said, isn't it way too late for anyone to put together some kind of new awakening and have the Sunnis marginalize ISIS and form some kind of unity government, Chalabi or Alawi or any other we? How is anyone going to accomplish what they failed to accomplish with the surge of 07 when all those benchmarks were never met and the Sunnis never were integrated into the government? How is anyone going to do that now?
Look, after all, I mean, this? And again, the biggest blame you get is he was, you know, Maliki is the one who gutted that whole program. On the way out, the American commanders, and again, I'm no big fan of the American occupation of Iraq or how it was handled, but I've talked to the guys who were involved in it, and they flat out told me, back in 2010. On the way out, they made us leave. We told them, you better keep paying these guys. You better bring them into the fold, or we're all just going to be back here in a couple of years. And Malachy refused the advice. Right. So what I would say is that description, that's the only way Iraq's going to become, you know, be brought back under any semblance of control. And the government that's in place in Baghdad has yet to show even the smallest sign that they're willing to take that first step, which is to incorporate some mainstream Sunnis into the government and start sitting down, drinking tea, talking to the tribes, and addressing their grievances. Only at that stage can you then you start talking about awakening councils and bringing this place back under control.
So, in other words, they're more likely to accept the independence of the new Islamic State. It's already a reality, right?
Well, it is a reality right now. The internal problems of that Islamic State are long and wide and deep. I know those tribal guys, they're not going to want to sit around with some guy giving lectures telling them exactly what Islam is and a bunch of British school shooters running around telling them that they're praying wrong. That's not going to go over real well with this conservative segment of Iraqi society. But until somebody makes a legitimate effort to reach out to these guys, and Malachy has proven he either can't or won't do it, then this place is going to be a mess. From a U.S. perspective, my guess would be that they're going to start putting in some special operations troops, probably in the north with the Kurds, who they have a good relationship with, and that they'll probably start putting up some armed drones just in case real international terrorists raise their heads that they can zap. But at this stage, I just do not see the movement on the ground for a significant military effort to help these guys out beyond telling them, well, this is what you should be doing if you weren't such an idiot.
Yeah, which is fine with me because, of course, whatever bad happens to ISIS doesn't need to be the Americans' fault. It's going to come to them anyway, I think, one way or the other.
Right, on some level. And I mean, I think that, frankly, it's a smart policy right now is nobody really knows what to do. There's no partner on the ground worth a damn to work with. So my guess would be that the Kurdish intelligence services are pretty good. They don't like these guys any more than anybody else. They're trying to stay neutral. And that there'll probably be some effort to make sure that this doesn't turn into a safe haven that can do damage beyond the areas that it already controls.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to fix the areas that they already control, it's a local solution. The West can only help. It cannot dictate.
Yeah.
This has to be done by the Iraqis, and until some Iraqi steps up with a plan and the sand in his belly to actually get some work done and make some hard choices, this place is screwed.
Right. Now, I got to let you go, but I never even really did ask you to tell me everything you know about this new emerging leader, and you know a hell of a lot. So maybe later this week we can catch up on that?
Yeah, that would be good. We can actually dedicate maybe half a segment to talking about the Caliph Ibrahim. He's a pretty interesting guy. I wish I knew more about him. I put in an interview request, but I just don't see that happening unless he wants to meet me in a 5-star hotel in Erbil.
Yeah. Well, you're way ahead of the curve there on trying and on what you've already been able to put together about him here in this piece. So anyway, thanks for your time, and I'll talk to you again soon then.
No problem at all. Always a pleasure, Scott. Take it easy.
All right, you too. All right, that's Mitchell Prothero, McClatchyDC.com. Islamic State releases video of Baghdadi in Mosul in new assertion of authority. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Who, me? What? It's my turn again? Hey, everybody. Welcome back. I kept him a little bit extra into the break there. Got a couple more answers out of him. I never did get a chance to ask him about this Baghdadi guy. You got to read this article, man. It's really good. Islamic State releases video of Baghdadi in Mosul in new assertion of authority. It's Mitchell Prothero at McClatchyDC.com. And it's really good, man. It's chock full of information all about this guy and what some of these expert types seem to make of what he had to say and what the implication of this statement was and that one and whatever. And it's well put together. I ain't claiming it's perfect or whatever. It's a well put together piece of journalism here, man. You ought to look at it. That's what I'm trying to say. This is just huge. I don't know. You know what? Maybe it's temporary. Maybe it's all overblown in the scheme of things, but it seems like this is some crazy legendary stuff going on right now in the world that these guys are living in the point of view that they're coming from. You know, there was an article by William S. Lind, the military strategist guy, paleo right-winger dude, where he took note. It was when there were Al-Qaeda attacks in Saudi Arabia, I think in 2004. Might have been 05. They did some attacks in Saudi Arabia, and the Saudi Arabian intelligence guys got their hands on the papers of the attackers. And the way that they wrote, and this is, you know, I don't know, it's only one anecdote, but I've heard others along these lines too, you know. As they talk, yeah, then Allah came and with the, you know, granted us the wind and helped us out the window and down the street with extra speed and whatever. So, in other words, as this guy put it in his sermon, we've been successful because God gave us the victory. Now, that can be some real serious talk for somebody who really believes that 100%. Not we were smart and we had Toyotas and we had guns and we won a battle or two or five. But God gave your Mujahideen brothers victory after long years of jihad and patience. So they declared the caliphate and placed the caliph, me, in charge, he said. I added the me because I'm being silly, but this is a duty on Muslims that has been lost for centuries. So, look, you and me, we think this guy is way too big for his britches, but the point is that when people talk with that much confidence, other people really like that kind of thing. You know? Man, this guy seems to be making a persuasive case that all you need is faith in Allah and an AK, and you can kick the foreign devils the hell out. We don't need no elected parliament. This ain't France. That's not how we do things around here. And take orders from the Shia? Not no more. And if you believe, pick up a gun and fight. That's his message. Pick up a gun and join us. Powerful message. When one can claim without irony that, no, really, this is all God's will playing out right in front of your eyes, and have people really glom onto that kind of thing. I don't know. Again, as he's saying, we're still talking about not that many people, but then again, I don't know who did the latest count. It must be growing. And if this guy's already out, you know, giving sermons like this, establishing his authority, claiming it, he's going to get more and more of it. You know, it's just a popularity contest. This is what I referenced. We didn't have time to talk about it, but I referenced Prothero's other piece recently that came out in McClatchy about what's going on in Syria. It's not even about that. That was just four or five paragraphs out of another great long-form piece there, update on all regions at war over there. And it was about how the al-Nusra commanders, many al-Nusra commanders, including al-Nusra commanders, these are the al-Qaeda guys in Syria. They're more Syrian and more bin Ladenite, more loyal to the goals of Zawahiri, is what makes them separate from ISIS. ISIS broke away and decided to do things their own way. Go ahead and create a caliphate now, not wait. And anyway, the Nusra guys are saying, okay, you're the caliphate. We swear allegiance to you. And they've handed over four or five towns in eastern Syria, what used to be eastern Syria. I take that seriously when Prothero says, you know, on the other side of the line that counts now only to map makers, that these guys don't recognize that border between Syria and Iraq anymore. And the thing is, you know, I don't know. I guess, again, if America and or Iran really got behind the Iraqi government and the Syrian government together to fight against ISIS, then they could crush them, really. I mean, who's got heavy weapons and who doesn't? The Americans can put firepower on targets. Now, These guys can fight an insurgency that the Americans can never defeat. But that doesn't mean that we can't destroy their attempted state. I'm not talking about that's a great idea. I'm just saying the Americans can. And I'm just playing out the logic of it, man. I don't see what anti-war movement or what sanity in the world can stop it. Although I have to admit that I'm pleasantly surprised by the reluctance so far. It's kind of how I started the show today. What do you mean we're not carpet bombing yet? We're not carpet bombing yet? I'm not complaining. That's wonderful. But I'm confused and mystified a little bit. They've sent armed drones, but they're not dropping hellfires. They've sent Apache helicopters, but they haven't massacred anyone. What are they waiting for? Do they know better and then they're behaving based on their information of what would be a bad idea to, you know, that they should not go ahead and do? Wow. It's like I'm living in a whole other world. You know. Hate to give Obama any credit at all, but here's your left-handed compliment. Could be worse, Mr. President. Now, then again, he could start the carpet bombing later today, and he was just waiting to get, you know, just enough planes in, you know, ready to go. Enough Marines ready to parachute in, but I don't know. It seems like the logic there is just inescapable. A bin Ladenite state? Here they've been complaining all along, these failed states, these lawless territories, this is the dangerous place where Al-Qaeda can reign. Well, what about they make a real government? And they own a whole bunch of oil wells and refineries. And they got all the spoils of war, sacking the central bank in Mosul, $500 million right there. Whatever other donor money and whatever other ransom money and whatever other revenue they got, collecting taxes and selling oil, that's a lot. Selling oil is more than a group like this has ever been able to do before. And I really think that our best chance against them is do nothing. Because really, I don't know, they can smash the state over there, but then it's just going to rise again. They can't stay forever. The American army cannot occupy the triangle of Sunni death or whatever forever and ever. At some point they gotta leave. It seems like it was American intervention that brought Al-Qaeda to Iraq. Ha! Paul Wolfowitz the other day literally tried to cite Zarqawi's presence in Kurdistan as the excuse for attacking Saddam again. Can you believe that? This guy. Doesn't he have a Smithers that tells him that, yeah, we don't use that one anymore? Everyone knows that was a lie, that Saddam gave him a peg leg and was his good friend, and he was also good friends with Osama and the tie between them. Everybody knows Saddam was trying to kill him. Everybody knows he had told Osama to go to hell. He didn't want to work for Osama either. Everybody knows he was safe in American-owned autonomous Kurdistan before the war. It was the invasion that turned Zarqawi loose and created the rise of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Hell, it was almost 2 years into the occupation before he even called his group Al-Qaeda in Iraq. It was still just Ansar al-Islam before that. Paul Wolfowitz. Anyway. Sorry, I got off on a Wolfowitz tangent. That happens sometimes. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show now. Hey, one thing I saw this morning, I think the Free Thought Project or Cop Watch, I think it was the Free Thought Project, had a story about some guys pulled over at one of these mandatory DUI stop things, and they were prepared because of what they'd been through last year. And blam, they had their video camera and a microphone. Like, you could tell you had 3 or 4 people in the car all prepared for this, recording and with audio and everything. And the cops immediately all say to each other, "Hey, everybody, be cool. Video, video. Hey, hey, video, video. Everybody be on your best behavior." Because they know they're criminals. And they know that what they're doing all day is wrong, violating people's rights. They have something to hide. That's why they're afraid of being videoed. Because they're not our servants, they're our overlords, and they act like it. But nobody, apparently, it's starting to get tiresome for these cops who become nationwide viral videos. That's their 15 minutes of fame in their whole life, is millions of strangers hate their guts for being caught on camera violating somebody's rights. Video, video, be cool. Video, video. Don't say anything stupid, Jimmy. And then let the kids go within a minute. All right, you don't have to give us your urine or your blood or your... Just get the hell out of here. Uh-huh. Little brother watching back. It's their technology, but we can turn it against them. A lot of great cop watchers are doing that. That's really important. And it just goes to show the guilty conscience. Right? They sound like kids drinking beer going, be cool, it's the cops. Hide the Budweiser behind your back. Not that that's really criminal, but it's illegal. You understand. So that's at free, the Free Thought Project, I think, is where I saw that. I want to mention about Afghanistan. Where's my Afghanistan section? Right here. BBC. Afghanistan's Ashraf Ghani leads an early vote count. What? The CIA's man, Abdullah Abdul, ain't winning? I guess they're all the CIA's men. That's what Eric Margulies said. Oh, yeah, nobody running didn't already win the all-white primary at Langley, Virginia. Former Afghan finance minister Ashraf Ghani is leading the race to replace Hamid Karzai as president, according to preliminary results. And this has been a dead heat and all kind of recounts and all this for quite a while now. But here we are. Mr. Ghani won 56.44% of votes cast in the 14th of June second round, the election commission said. His opponent, Abdullah, he was the guy that the CIA tried to install back in 2009, but Karzai outstole it from him. His opponent, Abdullah, had 43%, the commission said. Dr. Abdullah led after the first round and has alleged widespread fraud in the runoff. Votes are being rechecked at thousands of polling stations. The vote comes during a critical year for Afghanistan. Most foreign troops are due to withdraw by the end of 2014. Not all of them. Dr. Abdullah pulled out of Afghanistan's 2009 presidential election, which was also marred by claims of mass fraud. So, of course, it's only a contest of who can steal it better. And it's only a contest of who can steal it better among a handful of men who already auditioned for the U.S. government for permission to take the job. And what's funny about that is it means that they've got no legitimacy, and it means that we're just facing another Fall of Saigon-type moment like they may well be facing here in the Green Zone for too long, where these guys just have to flee hanging on to the skids of the Hueys, the Blackhawks. Get us the hell out of here, they'll cry. You know what's funny is, I remember asking Ann Jones, I should get Ann Jones back on the show. I should read Ann Jones' book and then get Ann Jones back on the show. But I said, so when the Americans leave, or in large numbers leave, are the Taliban just going to waltz right back into Kabul and take it? And she said, the Taliban's already in Kabul. The Taliban's already inside the government. There are high-level ministers who are Taliban. It's already happened. It's just a slow-motion retreat now. And, you know, I don't know. Hopefully, the Taliban aren't just going to massacre all of the Hazaras and Tajiks and Uzbeks and completely obliterate the people on their sides of the lines. Maybe they can work out a compromise. It sure doesn't seem like the surge worked at all. Never mind the Iraq surge, which is now playing itself out just wonderfully on the other side of Iran from there. But remember, they sold the surge, the Democrats and the Pentagon, They sold the surge, and Obama sold the surge as a strategy to whoop on the Taliban so bad while building up the Afghan state for the people of Afghanistan. You know, installing just the right technocrats to run everything just right for the people. While at the same time doing, you know, merciless night raids and attacks on the Taliban. And we would whoop them so bad, beginning in the end of 2009, really beginning in the beginning of 2009, that then by the summer of 2011, we'll bring them to the table and they'll have to accede to all of our demands. Doesn't this sound just like Nixon's plan, his secret plan to win peace with honor in Vietnam or something? Oh, yeah, peace. By which I mean I'm going to bomb them and bomb them and bomb them and bomb them, and then they're going to come to the table under our terms. Didn't work out for Nixon. Didn't work out for Obama either. Taliban are still on their own terms, as I've been trying to tell you since the fall of 01. All they got to do is not lose. It's their country. And the poor Pashtuns, you know, if America, even if you, you know, take into account the original regime change, if the Americans had just left after that, who knows what kind of, because the Taliban were completely obliterated. They didn't even start coming back together again at all in any meaningful way until 04, 05. In reaction to, you know, from the resentment from the American occupation is what drove their recreation. If the Americans had just left after letting Osama escape, then maybe the Pashtuns could have come up with strong enough systems of their own security forces and their own Loya Jirga governments and ways of doing things that they could have kept the Taliban out. But here they've had all this time with no chance to make their own political system whatsoever, other than to have the Taliban representing their interests. So they've been doubly screwed this whole time. And I guess it still remains to be seen whether Obama will even pull the last of the troops out of Afghanistan before the end of his term. And then what happens when Jeb comes, or when Hillary Clinton comes, sets the place on fire all over again? Or when the Taliban sacks Kabul and they go, who could have foreseen this? I guess it's the Dove's fault for ever leaving. We got to stay there forever. John Glazer put out a tweet like that recently. Yeah, the Hawks are right, you know? If only America continued, just invaded and completely and totally occupied Iraq, Iran, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Afghanistan, Pakistan. Why not Saudi Arabia? As long as, if we would just completely and totally occupy everything, everywhere, forever, then no one will ever resist us. It's the obvious truth. I saw John Yoo on just flipping through channels over the weekend. I saw John Yoo at AEI on C-SPAN. No lie. It would be like if he did a comic book about my life. I'm over at a friend's house, and there's John Yoo at AEI on C-SPAN. All right, what's he saying? Give war a chance. I'm sorry I can't say that, because PJ O'Rourke already took the title from me. But, you know, we have just this reluctance to start wars. He said the international ban on starting wars is really hampering America's ability to bring peace and democracy and love to the world. And then he cited Kosovo and Iraq as examples of where the ban on starting wars has prevented America from doing the right thing by people by invading them. Are you kidding me? This is the guy that wrote the memo that said, go ahead and torture any Iraqi to death that you feel like, any Afghan to death that you feel like. And he's complaining, and he doesn't sound all adamant and angry like me. He's very calm and sophisticated and says, well, you know, of course, we just have to keep waging wars all over the whole world forever in order to bring people peace and love. I think he might even really believe some of what he was saying. John Yoo. Oh, well. As long as he's there, I'll be here.